Today is Wednesday, May 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
The elections will be taking place over 4 days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, in the 28 member states.
That's reporter Catherine Field. We'll have more on the EU elections coming up. Also ahead, deadly clashes break out in Jakarta in the wake of the presidential election. And the United States delays restrictions on U.S. technology sales to Chinese tech powerhouse Huawei. It's all on today's International Edition. Indonesian President Joko Widodo says he will not tolerate anyone disturbing the country's democratic process after deadly clashes between police and supporters of Prabowo Subianto, the former army general who lost the recent election but is contesting the results. Jakarta's governor said at least 6 people were killed and more than 200 injured in the violence today. Reuters reporter Elizabeth Hennessy has more.
Protests that started peacefully in Indonesia turned deadly overnight. Joko Widodo's re-election as president sparked civil unrest in the capital, Jakarta. The country had been awaiting official results since the April 17 election. Soon after, supporters of Widodo's challenger took to the streets. Police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse crowds Tuesday night as protesters hurled fireworks and set private property ablaze. This was the scene on Wednesday. Riot police are bracing for further mass protests. Authorities have said 40,000 police and army personnel were on duty across Jakarta.
Pada waktu yang janggal.
Opposition candidate Prabowo Subianto has refused to concede defeat. He said on Tuesday he believes there'd been widespread cheating in the polls and was making legal efforts to, quote, defend the mandate of the people. An election supervisory agency said there was a lack of evidence to support claims of systematic cheating, and independent observers have said the poll was free and fair. The result released by the General Election Commission gave Widodo more than 55% of the votes. Some schools and offices in the capital have shut this week, as police say they've detained dozens of militant Islamists suspected of planning attacks.
That was Reuters reporter Elizabeth Hennessy. Well, starting tomorrow, citizens of the European Union vote to choose their next members of the European Parliament, who will shape the course of the EU over the next 5 years. In one of the most hotly contested campaigns so far, migration and identity are playing a big role. For a preview of the elections, I spoke with reporter Catherine Field.
The elections will be taking place over 4 days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday, in the 28 member states. Are for members of the European Parliament. Now, there's 751 members of the Parliament. They will serve a 5-year term and they will take their seats on the 2nd of July. It's generally thought that this European Parliament over the past few decades has lacked teeth. It hasn't really been able to get in on some of the more important issues of the day, which tend to have been taken over by national governments. But pretty much since the migrant crisis in 2015, it has had much more of a focus on giving the European Parliament the tools to be able to deal with European-wide issues. So they are coming into a phase where they will be dealing with more of these Europe-wide issues, and it's not just migration, it's also going to be on matters such as the environment, climate change, and also security.
Who will actually be voting in these elections?
Depending on which country, whether it's people who are on the electoral roll, age 18, some countries have different rules, but generally anyone of the people on the electoral roll in these 28 countries will have the right to vote. Now, there comes then the next problem, which is, will they turn out to vote? And that's always, again, been the problem with the European parliamentary elections, that people feel, voters feel just a little bit divorced from it. They don't really have a day-to-day following of it. So they are concerned that turnout across the European Union 28-member bloc will be low. That means somewhere between 40-45% turnout.
And who is considered to be among the biggest winners and losers?
At the end of the day, the parliament will probably end up looking pretty much as it does at the moment, which is the centre-right, centre-left and centrist parties will probably have around 430 seats. So that's more than the majority. The biggest winner, it really does depend. What everyone's looking at is how will the populist parties fare in these elections. These are the first European parliamentary elections since there has been this wave of populists and nationalists taking power in member states. So the big question will be, will these parties be able to scoop up the votes that they keep saying they will be able to? They will be the big winners if they push out the traditional parties in their home countries. And certainly all eyes will be on France, where President Emmanuel Macron's party is pretty much neck and neck with the far right Marine Le Pen, her National Rally Party. How that works out will really be an indication of what this big country of France feels about the European Union. So have a look at that one, because that will really be a midterm verdict on President Macron, and it will give an indication as to really what this key member of the EU, what the electorate feels towards the European Union. Will it be pessimistic? Will it be an electorate that will go for these populists who are standing for power? Or at the end of the day, will they just do what the opinion pollsters are saying, is they might not really like the way the European Parliament is running the show, but they do have a positive feel for the European Union.
That was reporter Catherine Field. She spoke with me from Paris. Among the top stories in the world, Taliban insurgents detonate a vehicle-borne bomb today in eastern Afghanistan, killing at least 3 people and injuring 15 others. British lawmakers denounce Prime Minister Theresa May's latest proposal to withdraw from the EU amid growing demands from her own Conservative Party for her resignation. And the Organization of American States urges Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega to stick to his agreement to unconditionally free all political prisoners by the June 18th deadline. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. A French woman whose husband died in the crash of a Boeing 737 MAX airliner in Ethiopia has filed a U.S. lawsuit against the plane maker, seeking at least $276 million in damages. The crash of Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 in March killed all 157 passengers and crew aboard, and followed the death in October of 189 people on a Lion Air 737 MAX, which plunged into the ocean off Indonesia in similar circumstances. Dozens of families have sued Boeing over the Lion Air crash, and several lawsuits have been lodged over the Ethiopian crash near the capital Addis Ababa, which led airlines around the world to ground the Boeing 737 MAX. In addition, China is stepping up pressure on Boeing as its airlines demand compensation for the grounding of the 737 MAX jetliners. Two of 3 major state-owned carriers, Air China LTD and China Southern Airlines LTD, said today they want compensation for their aircraft being grounded. The third, China Eastern Airlines LTD, announced a similar request last month. While the United States is delaying restrictions on U.S. technology sales to Chinese tech powerhouse Huawei for 90 days in what it calls an effort to ease the blow on owners of its cell phones and smaller U.S. telecoms providers that rely on its networking equipment, the Trump administration insists the sanctions are unrelated to its escalating trade war with China. Huawei is the world's biggest maker of mobile network gear and the number 2 smartphone brand. The U.S. claims Huawei is a cybersecurity risk and has targeted it against the backdrop of a wider trade war with China. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Michael Swain, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, why the U.S. has taken the stand it has with Huawei and, on a broader stand, China.
Some people say that this whole effort is part of basically a negotiating gambit on the part of Trump, right? He's trying to put pressure on the Chinese The trade dispute is worsening. Their negotiations have basically fallen through, and they're trying to get them going again. Trump is looking for greater leverage, the argument goes, and here's Huawei. This is a real source of leverage for him in trying to get the Chinese to agree to his trade goals. And if they do agree, then maybe he will relent. If you're talking about the U.S. position on this, it's partly an issue of the kind of access that Huawei could get to the U.S. internet system to be used for either spying or to damage the U.S. internet system because of the very wide use of Huawei devices and hardware. But I think it goes even beyond that. I mean, it really goes to the question of, is the United States going to try to insulate China or isolate China and its telecommunications and its electronics from itself and from the Western world? Is it trying to reinforce the idea of a electronic wall, if you will, in which you have two separate operating systems in the world, one of which is basically Chinese oriented and the other one is Western oriented or Western allied oriented?
Doesn't the decision by the United States to block Huawei in any way it's seemingly possible foster that, basically forcing the Chinese to come up with their own ways to complete their system?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what it's doing. I mean, this is part of the dilemma that the United States is in. Huawei relies a lot on American chips. It is not as sophisticated a producer, and China in general isn't, as I understand it. I'm not an insider on this, but I talk to people who do know a lot about it. And there's a lot of supply dependency on the part of Huawei on U.S. manufactured chips and other hardware. And this action by the United States, if it follows through on it, will provide increased motivation for the Chinese to, in fact, separate that dependency and develop their own chips. Now, the question there is, of course, how long would it take for them to do that? And would Huawei remain viable as a company over the period of time in which it's trying to really reduce its dependency on U.S. suppliers? And some people say it can be done in relatively short order, and other people say, no, it will take years to happen. And in the meantime, Huawei could be in jeopardy of actually surviving as a corporation.
Well, apparently what has happened with the decision by Google to pull out, although it apparently has not been doing business with Huawei in China for a while, this just hurts Huawei's customers in China, not around the world, and will hurt their business worldwide rather than in China in both ways. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of its devices that are used in China are also dependent upon U.S. suppliers. One other big issue here is European companies, as I understand it, are more dependent upon or utilizing Huawei hardware than in the United States. In the United States, apparently, Huawei is a supplier in rural areas of the U.S. for internet devices of various types, routers and that sort of thing. In Europe, though, I think the dependency and the distribution there is much greater. So the question there, I mean, you've already seen Europeans have tried to basically adopt a middle ground dealing with Huawei. The UK, for example, is putting the Huawei systems through an examination in which they're trying to seal off certain parts of Huawei from the UK government and then permit Huawei to operate in other areas. With this recent action by the United States to put Huawei on the so-called entity list of national security concerns or threats, it basically is trying to prohibit American companies overall from dealing with Huawei. It's not just U.S. government entities, which is the previous decision that the U.S. had made. It's now extended to U.S. companies writ large, civilian companies.
What has this done and what might this do in the future to U.S.-China relationships?
The United States now has identified China as essentially an existential threat. It's a threat to the global order from the U.S. position. It's a threat to American interests and American security. It's a revisionist world power put in the same basic category as Russia and Iran, and it's now being treated increasingly as if that is the case.
That was Michael Swain, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. This is VOA's International Edition.
The lyrics dialects could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the Voice of America.
Well, two Rwandan men linked to the murder of eight Western tourists in Uganda in the late 1990s have been allowed to resettle in Australia as part of a refugee swap deal with the United States. An Australian man who survived the attack says he is shocked the suspects have been granted asylum. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Two men were secretly resettled in Australia despite being accused of killing tourists. Four Britons, two Americans and two New Zealanders who were on a guerrilla watching tour in Uganda in the late 1990s. The suspects arrived in Australia last November as part of a deal to exchange refugees made between Canberra and the Obama administration in 2016. Though he criticised the agreement that seen the transfer of a few hundred refugees from Australian migrant detention centres in the South Pacific, President Trump has honoured it. The Rwandan men were extradited to the US following the killings and held in immigration detention for 15 years after efforts to convict them failed. Their transfer to Australia has prompted difficult questions for the government on the eve of a general election. A former New Zealand minister said the resettlement was incredibly insensitive. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison says the men were carefully vetted.
The two individuals that have been subject of this reporting were subject to the security and character assessments and the work that must be done in terms of assessing whether there are any war crimes that are associated with persons who are coming as a refugee. And that security process cleared those individuals.
Peyton Rookie is an Australian who survived the atrocity.
I still can see images of people. I can still hear the gunshots. I can still see the burning truck. I can still see, you know, the unfortunate person who was murdered. And I can still vividly remember the reactions of other people when they found out the news that we had people killed. I didn't understand why we would let two people accused of this into Australia.
The suspects were reportedly members of a Hutu rebel group in Rwanda, which had links to the 1994 genocide of the minority Tutsi community. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you, Phil. Well, Pope Francis has appointed two auxiliary bishops to Santiago, Chile. They are the first bishops who have been appointed to the South American nation since the entire bishops' conference offered its resignation due to what the pontiff described as a culture of cover-up when it comes to clerical abuse. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA from Rome.
The newly appointed auxiliary bishops are Carlos Irarra Saval, Errázuriz, and Alberto Lorenzelli Rossi, both of whom served as priests in the Chilean capital. The latter is an Italian Argentine who arrived in Chile 5 years ago and is not part of the long-standing divisions existing among the clergy in Santiago. The appointments came 1 year after an emergency summit took place at the Vatican to discuss the clerical sexual abuse scandal engulfing the Catholic Church in Chile. In May of last year, in the wake of the scandal, and in an unprecedented move by an entire national bishops' conference, all 34 bishops in Chile offered to resign. The bishops made the announcement after having attended the crisis meeting with Pope Francis about the cover-up of clerical sexual abuse in their country. They had signed a document en masse in which they put their fate in the hands of the Pope.
Queremos pedir perdón por el dolor causado a las víctimas.
At the time, the bishops also apologized for the pain caused to the victims of abuse, to the Pope, to the people of God, and to Chile, for their serious mistakes and omissions. In a strongly worded document on the scandal, Francis said the entire Chilean church hierarchy was collectively responsible for grave defects in handling cases and the resulting loss of credibility that the Catholic Church had suffered in the country. This past March, the Pope accepted the resignation of 77-year-old Cardinal Ricardo Izzati Andreio, Archbishop of Santiago, who had been accused of covering up for crimes of abusive priests. The Pope appointed Bishop Celestino Aos Braco of Copiapó as Apostolic Administrator of Santiago. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Well, women who get good prenatal care before they deliver vastly increase their chances to have healthy babies. But what happens after they give birth? VOA's Carol Pearson reports a survey of mothers in the U.S. shows they slack off on their own health needs, which doesn't help them with a new baby.
When a woman has good prenatal care, the 9 months she's pregnant are filled with doctor visits and focused on her health and the baby's. But what about the 3 months after she gives birth?
Good morning, Lima.
Rachel Cobb says she felt totally unprepared.
People have been doing this forever, and it's this shared experience that everyone has, yet I feel so lonely, and I don't know how to ask for help.
This period is known as the fourth trimester. That's when women's bodies are going through massive changes. Dr. Megan Gray at Orlando Health says this period is just as important for a mother's health as her pregnancy.
The fourth trimester is overwhelming, and I don't think anyone can be fully prepared for it.
A survey by Orlando Health finds that more than a quarter of women in the U.S. did not plan for their own health management following delivery. 40% said they felt overwhelmed or depressed.
It's very important for new moms to follow up with their midwives or their physicians, ideally sooner rather than later.
It's especially difficult for new mothers.
You immediately feel like I'm a bad mom because I feel this way, and you're not.
For poor women, it's far worse. A study by Professor Robert Keefe at the University at Buffalo shows that poor African-American and Hispanic mothers struggle more than white middle-class women.
Many of these mothers, having low incomes, find they're unable to pay the high costs associated with maintaining a healthy diet or getting regular exercise or simply finding time to take care of themselves.
Keith found that these women feel uncomfortable talking to caregivers with different racial or ethnic backgrounds.
Some of the mothers I've interviewed indicated that they were very worried that if they told an agency staff person that they were having troubles keeping up with their baby's service needs, that the staff member may call an agency that might come and take the baby away from the mother.
Yet it's critical that all women have regular medical care during the fourth trimester.
A lot of it is just reassurance, but some of it needs to be treated.
Keefe says U.S. health policies need to change so these mothers receive good care, and health professionals need to be able to step in to work out solutions, even if it involves reaching out to others in the community. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Cyclone Idai battered parts of southern Africa, wreaking havoc and creating a massive humanitarian crisis. An in-depth look at how the international community and the local governments are dealing with this evolving crisis on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's
Press Conference USA. This week, I talked with three co-hosts of VOA's newest roundtable discussion show, Our Voices, which focuses on African women's points of view. It's the first time VOA has produced content exclusively driven by female journalists on serious topics affecting the continent. That's Press Conference USA, Saturday and Sunday, on The Voice of America.
Hello and welcome to